Hola, antes de empezar necesito pedir perdón por hacer esta charla en inglés. Lamentablemente, a pesar que vivo en la Argentina ya hace 2 años, todavía mi castellano es bastante malo. Okay, now in English. I will talk about one of my hobby projects that's called TCP Connection Passing. And we will soon get some feedback. And here's a brief overview of the items I will discuss. First of all, I will describe the history and the goals of this project. Then I will talk about possible applications of it. And I will also, in case you don't like TCP/CP, then there are also some alternatives you might use. Then I will go into the technical details. How the connection passing procedure works, and also how some related things need to be handled, like for instance switching the traffic in the network. Then I will briefly talk about some advanced issues like testing, congestion control, checkpointing, and I also have a little demo, but unfortunately need a higher screen resolution for the demo, so I can show this offline afterwards. Now, how all of this began. I went to Linux Congress 2 years ago, and there was a talk on fault tolerance by Fabio Oliveira Leite from Conectiva in Brazil. So that's kind of how it works when you learn about the Linux projects of people who live basically two hours by plane away from you. You go to another continent and meet them there. And so he was describing how to pass IP addresses from one host to another in a typical failover scenario. So he was presenting a very elegant solution for moving the IP address. Unfortunately, after moving that IP address, you would have to reestablish your TCP connections. Okay, this sort of made sense. I mean, everybody knows that TCP connections are not easy things to move, but it got me wondering, so why is it so difficult? I mean, it should be feasible, right? And well, then I set off on a nice little blue sky research project, and this is what this is all about. So the goals of this are to pass a live TCP connection from one host to another. Over here, you can see the typical configuration scenario where you have two machines, two servers, and one client. The client is somewhere on the internet, might be far away from these machines, doesn't know anything about them, only knows that it wants to connect there. And now one of those servers at one given time decides that it doesn't want to handle the connections from that client anymore, and now passes the ownership of its end of the connection to the other server. And the idea is, of course, that the connection is not interrupted and that the client doesn't even notice what is going on here. So it doesn't need to implement any special protocols for this. You don't need to install any additional applications or anything. You just take the client as it is. It might even not be a Linux machine. It could even be something as horrible as Windows. And it would still work. And another thing that would be nice to have is to make the changes not too nasty on the server side, so that you don't have to rewrite everything over there. But it's kind of second priority. Lo and behold, this kind of thing might even have some possible uses, even though I did mainly just for the more academic interest. First of all, if you have process migration, things like OpenMOSIX or so, then it's really nice if you're able, when you move a process from one machine to another machine, that you can also move the connections along with it. But MOSIX, well, I'm not quite sure what they're doing at the moment, but at least a few years ago, they implemented this as follows. They were moving the whole process with all its files and everything from one machine to the other, but they couldn't move the TCP connections. So on the machine from which you moved the process, on this machine there was running an agent, which was inheriting all the TCP connections, receiving data, sending data, and forwarding it to the other machine. Now you could say, well, okay, it's not perfectly pretty, but it's not too bad either. I mean, if you assume that your cluster is, say, connected by connected to a high-speed network, so you might have, say, 10 gigabits between your machines, so you don't really care about wasting a little bit of bandwidth. Of course, unless you really care about your CPU resources and all that, there you already have something more interesting. And another problem is if you migrated your process because you wanted to shut down one of the machines. Then, of course, it's not so good if you have to keep that machine alive because there's this agent. So for this, it would be something useful. Another thing is, let's say you want to do some load balancing, and you don't want to do kind of the easy, simple load balancing that everybody knows, let's say for web servers, but instead you want to say, find out a little bit about that request that is coming, and only then you dispatch your request. So let's say you have a big farm of file servers. Let's say you do video on demand, and your file servers, one file server gets all the movies that start with an A, the other one gets all of those that start with B, and so on, till server Z. Now, you don't want to show all of this to the people who connect to your service, so you just have a dispatcher machine at the beginning. They connect to this dispatcher machine. This dispatcher machine starts to accept the HTTP connection until it gets the complete GET request, and it says, okay, now let's look into this GET request. GET, blah, let's say, Spider-Man, okay. Now, we take this connection, which we have accepted on the local machine, put it in a little packet, send it over to the server S, and tell it, now please send Spider-Man to this guy. And you can do something even a bit more interesting. I mean, if this is a service that is authenticated, then you might do the authentication on this gatekeeper and only tell the server that is actually handling the request that this connection is now properly authorized to do this. So this means that all of your data servers don't need to touch the authentication data. So if there's any risk that somebody might compromise your server after a while by doing nasty things with it, well, you don't care. You lose your file server, but no critical data is lost. That is great for having different security domains. The other things, like checkpoint restart, that's the kind of the failover scenario. Well, with TCP/CP as it is at the moment, there's some limitations to this. You can't do everything you would like. But what you can do is you can take a checkpoint of a TCP connection and exit your program, for instance, and then restart from the checkpoint. So you can use this, for instance, for a software update. Let's say you have Apache, I don't know what the current version is, 2.1 or so, running there, and then you decide I want to replace it, install a new version with some critical bug fixes or so. And I don't want all the users that are currently connected to this web server and doing things to even notice that the software has gone away. Okay, so you just dump the whole state, switch over to the new one, bring it up, it reloads the state, and people continue. Okay, it's not that easy to do it in real life, but you get the idea. Another thing is failover, in case some hardware is really breaking. Now, what you can't do with TCP/CP at the moment is that you have two machines and you just connect to one machine and then, well, at trade shows, some companies that implemented failover solutions, that those demos where you had those two servers and you had a block of concrete suspended above it, and then they would say, okay, now we are demonstrating the failover, they would release the block of concrete, it would smash the machine. Obviously, no data is ever going in and out of that machine anymore, and woof, the other machine would take over and things would proceed smoothly. You can't do this with TCP/CP at the moment. What you can do, though, is if you have a little bit of early warning, then you can start to move things away and hope you get rid of everything before the machine really has to go down. So if the guy is reaching for this concrete block, then you can start moving your connections and you will still make it. Now, in real life, there are other things you can, other indications you have. For instance, what is the most typical thing that goes wrong to a machine? Well, maybe it's a power failure. So on your servers, you have a little bit of uninterrupted power supply. So power goes down, server switches over to the UPS, which is hopefully even working. And it sends a warning to the server that you have some power management, whatever, demon, which receives this warning and says, okay, now we're losing power. Not good. But I mean, we still have, say, 20 minutes of battery power left. So nothing to panic about either. So you keep on going. After 5 minutes, you check, well, what's happening? Is the power back? Oops, no. Okay, so there might be something nastier going on. So then you can start moving things away to a machine which has more power. Maybe it's in a different building where you have some diesel aggregates or so. This type of things. Or if you have a fan failure, well, eventually your machine will overheat, so you don't want to ignore the fan failure, but still it will not just burst into flames immediately. So you have maybe a few minutes even until the machine is really getting too hot. So you can use this time to move your connections away and all your applications. Now, if you don't like TCP/CP, there are alternatives. Well, one thing is you can just break the connection and let the peer fix it. works great with existing infrastructure. You don't have to change anything. Of course, this causes some delays, and sometimes you don't even have any automatic recovery. Typical cases are SSH or X11, which are particularly annoying if you're, say, in OpenOffice writing a long document and all of poof, your window disappears. Also with HTTP, it's similar, although there are people who are more used to having some unpleasant experience, which is, of course, also a good thing for you. I mean, learn from the fast food industry. Maybe people actually don't expect any good service. So even better for you, no work. And another problem is, of course, if you want to implement one of those complicated things that I've mentioned before with authentication or so, or getting a bit of a request and then trying to figure out what to do. This is really hard to do if you depend on connections being restarted. I mean, in the case of web, of HTTP, and so you could play with cookies and so, but it's all kind of messy and with lots of obscure failure scenarios. Another possibility is that you rely on a higher level protocol to do redirection. Again, this works with the existing infrastructure normally. Problem is that not every protocol supports this. Well, HTTP does, that's cool. The only problem is that you still can't do it in every state. I mean, once you've started to download, say, your movie, which will run for 2 hours, and after 1 hour you say, okay, actually, I'd rather serve this from a different machine because I want to maintain that other machine now. Well, you can't do a redirect at that time. There are other alternatives. That's a really popular one. You take an intermediate layer with its own which implements its own transport, its own rules. This is great. It gives you maximum flexibility, but this is what the clustering people really do a lot. The only problem is that all of your machines need to talk the same protocol. Okay, that's fine for the clustering people, but it gets kind of nasty when you have to deal with connections that are coming from the outside world. I mean, it's good if you do it in your cluster. You have maybe 10 or 100 machines that you need to upgrade, but fine, you're installing the same software on all of them anyway. So, no big deal. Now, let's assume you do this with your web service. Here you have a little farm of web servers. Again, they're upgraded in a few hours, no problem. Okay, now the only thing that's missing is other clients. So there are those 500 million or so Windows machines out there. And anyway, so yeah, application integration might be a bit tricky. Also, if you use a slightly more clever approach, when you insert, say, a library underneath things which takes over the socket calls and emulates the normal API and does its own thing underneath, they can make it pretty transparent to the applications. That's already good. You don't need to recompile and rewrite all your applications. The only problem is that you also need to preserve the semantics. So sometimes they use some interesting socket options, or maybe they do some really freakish things like forking off another process and sharing the file descriptor, well, the socket, just by the means of forking. Or maybe they take this socket and they send it over a Unix domain socket with file descriptor passing to another process. So if you want to support all those things, well, good luck. Another possibility is that you just don't try to do anything fancy with TCP. You put in a proxy, which terminates all the TCP connections, and then does your own thing with your servers and so. That's also a pretty good approach, actually, because you can hide any mechanism with this, no matter what you're doing. Even if you're using avian carriers afterwards, that's fine. The only problem is that now your gateway machine gets a little bit more complicated, because now it's not just a router that needs to forward packets and doesn't do much. If it's a simple router, it's even more complex than a netbox, which only needs to remember connections. But now you also need to buffer data and have all those timers and so on. So your box is growing. Another problem is that your box might become a bottleneck. First of all, it might become a performance bottleneck. And the other thing is that it might also become a single point of failure. So, of course, you can try to distribute your box and have shared state and all of this, but it's getting kind of messy. Okay, now let's assume all those interesting alternatives didn't discourage you from wanting to use TCP/CP. This is how it works. There are basically three things that are being used in there. One is the application state. That's the most complex part. That's why I'm not dealing with that. That's basically all the information that the application has about this connection. Now, if you're just serving static files, This the information on the application side is just the file position. Okay, that's easy. If you are, say, a search engine, then this information might be a query string. If you are a web shop, then it's the complete shop contents and all maybe the discounts that this customer qualifies for, maybe the purchase history, whatever. So it can get complex. This how you solve this, this is really application specific. If you have something as powerful as process migration, all the complexity gets smaller again because somebody has done all the work for you already. So you just dump your entire process with all the additional information like open files and all that, plus the TCP connections, and move that one around. Makes things simpler. But you need to have a more powerful infrastructure. Then there's the TCP connection state in the kernel. This is what TCP/CP is really all about. And last but not least, you also need to make sure that the packets that have been going to the machine that you moved away from now go to the machine that you've moved to. That can also be a bit tricky. I will go to this also in a moment. Now, since TCP/CP only addresses the kernel part, it's just a building block for building a complete solution. So you can integrate this, say, with an application if the application isn't too complicated. Or you can also, let's say, even whip out the APIs and use this thing in a process migration scenario like Mosaic or so. Now, let's see of how this is really done. Here we have again our two servers and our client. Now we have a little bit more information about what's going on inside all of these things. On the origin, where the connection comes from, you have the application and you have the TCP state in the kernel. Now when moving this across the other machine, you need to move the kernel state, the application state, plus you need to redirect your network connection. Now the things that you have to move on the TCP side, first of all, the connection identifier, which is the source and destination IP address, source and destination port number. You might use it as is, or if you're using a NAT to switch your network connection, then you might also want to change some bits in there, for instance, the source IP and port address, IP address and port number. Then there are some negotiated capabilities which are set up when the TCP connection is established, and you cannot change them for the lifetime of your connection. So they also need to be propagated from passing the connection. These include things like window scaling, the maximum segment size, if you're using timestamps, or even if you're using selective acknowledgments. Other things that you need to move are, of course, the sequence numbers. That's the main source of synchronization in TCP. So you really need these. Then there's the flow control window. The problem is, well, what the flow control window does is that it tells the sender how much data you can send without asking for any further information. So it basically tells you how much buffer space is there. Now the problem is that you cannot shrink the window. Well, at least you shouldn't. Some TCPs still do this, but it's not considered to be a nice thing to do. So we have to also have to preserve this flow control window. Then there are the timestamps. They're kind of tricky. They're actually the only thing that's really complicated in TCP/CP because the kernel uses a central source for timestamps. All the timestamps that are generated by a single machine come from the same timer, from the same time counter. And now if you go to another machine, those time bases are not synchronized, so you would have timestamps that are either far in the future, but that's not too bad, or they're in the past, and that's really bad. So you have to avoid that. So what I'm doing is that I record the current value of the timestamp source at the origin and just send it along. And then at the destination, I calculate the difference between the two, and then I'm adding an offset. And at every place in the kernel where the timestamp is used, I'm replacing this with a function that just adds the offset to the local timestamp. So for normal local connections, the offset is zero, but for the TCP/CP connections, it's non-zero. And last but not least, there's the send retransmit buffer. That's the data that has been sent by the application, but which has not been acknowledged by the peer. And unfortunately, this data is no longer visible to the application, so we need to take care of this in TCP/CP itself. Fortunately, there are also some items we don't have to deal with. First of all, the receive buffer. The application can already retrieve everything in the receiver for simply by reading it. So what we do is that as soon as we start this moving process, we'll leave it to the application to actually retrieve the data. And this even gives the application a bit more flexibility because it can choose what it wants to do with the data. Either it can just send it along with all the rest of the information, or it can decide to process the data immediately and send just the states that it has reached after processing the data along. A bit more flexibility for the application, that's always nice. Then there's the out of order buffer. This is the data that has been received, but there's something missing that should come before it. Loss recovery is pretty tricky in TCP, and the good thing is that we're actually allowed to lose almost everything, unless we have explicitly acknowledged it to the other side. And TCP/CP is currently making heavy use of that. So things that we can lose is the out-of-order buffer. We have received those things, but there's something missing before, so the other side has to send something more anyway. Great. So we pretend we lost everything. Selective acknowledgement. We acknowledge also for partial data that we receive, that we have received it. Fortunately, selective acknowledgements are specified as allowing us that we can change our mind. We can say, oh, well, we received that and received that, and oh, no, actually, we didn't receive anything. And it also works in the other way around. If you receive any incoming SACs, we might remember them, but we can also decide to just ignore them. So the other side will not complain if it has sent us a SAC and it knows that we have received the SAC. If we still tell it that we need some data that it has known from the SAC that we have received. But it's good. Makes life simple. Last but not least is the congestion control state. This is fairly tricky to do. TCP/CP currently uses an extremely conservative and fortunately also extremely simple approach. It just assumes that the connection has sort of suffered some horrible trauma and is nice to start back again from zero. So it goes back to slow start and we're very conservative there, but possibly quite inefficient. Now, all of this is summarized on this nice and easy slide. Here we have our origin and our destination. On each side we have an application and our buffers. This is the out-of-order buffer, this is the receive buffer, this is the send buffer. Here this is the TCP in the kernel with its internal variables and all that. Here we have a router or a switch, a netbox, whatever. It's just a black box. And somewhere out there, over here, there's the client. And there's the internet between the two. So we have this thing on the origin and we have the same stuff on the destination. Now when the application decides that it wants to move that connection, what it does, it first of all calls a function, implemented this using a socket option. It does a get ICI. ICI is the internal connection information. This tells the kernel to first of all isolate the connection because we don't want to have any packets coming in or accidentally being sent out after we start to move the connection. So what it does, it really blocks the connection, it becomes completely dead, any incoming packets are deleted. If the stack still tries to send packets, then they're just dropped. This is fine because TCP allows us to lose anything we want. And it's a great lazy protocol, yes. And so what we do then is that we take all the variables from TCP and put them into our internal connection information, just the ICI. Then we retrieve the send buffer, put it there too. We even retrieve the out-of-order buffer because, well, it's sort of nice to retrieve it, even if we're not going to use it. Next thing is that the application has to empty the receive buffer. And then it takes all of this plus its internal state and sends it along to the happy new owner of the connection, this guy here. Now what this one does is that it goes to its kernel, tells it, here's information for a new connection, please set it up. First, it has already opened the socket. So now we're putting back the variables into the TCP, we set up all the data structures for the route and for the destination, neighbor and so on. Also, we verify that things are actually compatible. I mean, you could have the scenario that this guy was using timestamps and this one is using a kernel that doesn't have timestamp support in it. That would be really annoying. So things can still go wrong, But anyway, so we just reestablish things, we copy the buffer content back, we discard the out of order buffer, and well, eventually everything is ready to go here. Now the next step we have to do is that we have to switch the network connection so that packets that are coming from the client don't go to this machine anymore, but now to this machine. And anything we send from here will actually make it out. Again, this guy might block things that don't seem to come from the right machine. So we need to go to talk to this guy and switch things over. And then, almost last, we can activate the connection. What happens then is that we send either a window probe or we retransmit any data if you have anything to retransmit. So to make sure that something is happening and that we don't have to wait for the client on the other side till it eventually notices that things have come back to life. And well, the last thing we can do is that now we can kill everything on that side here. While we were still setting up things on the destination, we were not allowed to take down this part. Particularly the isolation is important, because let's assume we would take it down immediately after we sent the connection off here. This stack the connection would disappear on that machine. Now, if a new packet comes in and still goes to the old machine, the stack sees it and says, okay, this is for port number 1700 something. Well, this port doesn't exist. So there must have been an error. So it sends back a reset. And of course, the application on the other side will say, oh, connection reset by peer, we die. So we need to keep things quiet a little bit longer. Okay, that much about the kernel side. Now this little black box over there, it's really interesting. Even though I'm not really intending to do much over there, it's still interesting to think about what has to happen at that place. Well, first of all, what are the requirements for switching a network connection? First of all, it must work at the IP level or below. It should be reasonably quick. And it should scale for bandwidth, which means don't do anything that needs a lot of computation. It should scale for redundancy in the sense that you have multiple parallel paths, so if, say, one of your routers goes down, then you can just flip over to another one, or in general, one of your boxes goes down. I mean, it would be just too bad if you now have great redundancy on your servers, but you still have one really critical machine on the edge, which needs to survive at any cost. And of course, it would also be nice if this machine wasn't too much of a pain to implement and maintain. So there are, again, several possibilities for doing that kind of thing. Something that's really easy to do is local routing. Like in this scenario here, you just have your servers. Each of them has its own IP address. Plus, in addition to this, you set up a second IP address, which we call IPX. Both servers have this IP address. So when they receive a packet with that IP address, they will accept it. When they send a packet for a connection that is related to this IP address, we'll have that IP address. And the router decides which machine actually gets the packets for this IP address. Well, it's pretty easy. You just do a route add for this IPX address, gateway, whatever server gets this. It might get a little bit more complicated if you have other routers between those two machines, but in principle, it's something that's easy to do. So if you want to switch over your connection, all you have to do is, well, first of all, move the things on the server side, which you already know how to do. And now switch over things on the network side, which is pretty easily done here. You just delete the old route and you set up a new route that goes to the new server. Easy. Great. Okay. You don't need anything new at the router. Your router can already do this, or whatever it is. It's very, very efficient, actually. If you have multiple routers connecting to your network, you can just use the same approach on all of those routers. So it's also easy to distribute this thing. Unfortunately, there are some things that would be nice to... Sometimes it would be nice to move a single connection. Not all of the connections from that machine at once. And you cannot do this with that approach. You really have to move everything. And in addition to this, you also create a single area of failure, because everything that gets routed to this address IPX still needs to reach one of your machines. Usually this is not a big problem, but if you're designing such an architecture, you might want to keep this in mind, that in some cases it might be something that's undesirable. But still, usually the properties of the local routing approach are pretty good. The only problem is you don't have the granularity. There are some variations to this theme. You could use a shared media instead of a router. Let's say the router is owned by your network service provider, so you cannot really go there and reconfigure it. Well, you might still be able to play with things at a shared media. You just connect them to the same broadcast media, the two servers, and configure them both to the same address, and you just filter packets. And well, now if I talked about local routing, no, why not use global routing? I mean, after all, this is really distributed, scales great. Unfortunately, it's also a little bit hard to do. I mean, I don't know how many of you speak BGP as a second language. I don't. It might also be a little bit sort of fishy and undesirable. So when you do it and you tell people about it, they might sort of start looking for sticks and stones and knives. I mean, if you remember experiments like a VeriSign SiteFinder, what they did was they were owning the some top-level domains like everything under .com. That was the company was in charge of that. So what they did was thought, well, actually, I mean, when you say want to go to Google and you mistype this, then sometimes you end up at the site of some domain grabber that says, hey, we have great search engine products, or use our own list of sponsored links for finding the stuff that you were really looking for. They thought, well, that's a good idea. But hey, why do all this work of registering tons of little domains? We can do better. We can do a wildcard record that says anything that isn't registered is ours. Lo and behold, people at the IETF were really unhappy about that, because sometimes you just want to get an error message if for some reason another system cannot be reached, for instance because the name server is down. You don't want to be temporarily redirected to some basically big e-commerce site. This type of things. So whenever you do things at a grand scale in the internet, you have to be a little bit careful. So this is one of these. In addition to that, it has poor granularity, because again, you have to move all the connections at once, so this doesn't change. Something that's even nastier is that it might take a long time for this transition to actually happen. Because when you update your routing when you send your routing update, well, of course, the next router might respond to this fairly quickly. It might not respond to it immediately, because usually routers are a bit conservative and don't trust all those updates they get, because sometimes there's something broken in the internet and it just sends updates every second or so. So they will just throw away lots of updates, wait a little bit, see if the update is still valid, and yeah, okay, maybe now something has really changed. And, well, that's one thing. The other thing is, once you've started the transition, it might take a long time till the whole internet has realized that that the IP address that the route is now different. I mean, in the best case, you can assume about 5 minutes for routing change to propagate the internet. In the worst case, well, an hour is certainly not such a bad estimate, which of course means that you cannot move all your connections at once and expect to show up duck on the other side. It might still be useful to do in some scenarios to try something like that, but it's a bit tricky. Anyway, let's talk about some nice approaches. One is NAT. I really like NAT, because now you can move individual connections. Great, all the flexibility you want. Even better, each connection can go to a different new machine. And unfortunately, also some problems. First of all, it consumes more resources than just routing, because now you have to keep track of every single connection. Okay, that's not so bad. It might create a single point of failure. On Linux, we still don't have any NAT that is actually distributable. I hear that Harald Welt is working on that, and next week I'll go to Ottawa to the Linux symposium there, and he will talk about that. So maybe I can remove this bullet. And last but not least, also the state synchronization with the host is a little bit tricky. Let's say you do a completely statically configured NAT. So the host says, now for this port, for this host and that port, you go to another machine and another port. Okay, easy to do. And now what happens if the application dies on the new host? Well, of course, you have to go to your NAT and tell it, oh, by the way, the connection is now dead, please remove it. Okay, if you leave it to your application to clean up after itself, you might be in for some surprises. You could, of course, delegate this to the operating system and insert a little hook that says, okay, whenever a connection gets closed, we go to this user space program that will decide, oh, take it down, also on the net. That's something you can do. Now, what happens if your host goes down? Lots of unpleasant problems there. You can solve all of them by using connection tracking or something equivalent. Now it's more a problem on the implementation side because we don't have the possibility to actually go into your connection tracking table and edit your entries in there. But that's actually something that I want to play with because, it's, again, it sounds like something interesting and a little bit dirty. And there are other possibilities. You can use tunnels, VPNs, mobile IP, Anycast. Invent your own. I mean, the world is full of creative abuses of TCP/IP. So the only limits that are really there are self-imposed. Use your creativity. Just one warning. Even though there are lots of solutions, not all of them are particularly nice, and sometimes they just fall over when your parameters change a little bit. So you have to be a bit careful. But nevertheless, this is a great fun area to play with. Okay. Now let's move on to some things that should happen in the future. And well, as everybody knows, it's good for software quality to do a lot of testing, quality assurance, and all of that. I share this opinion. That's why I marked it as a to-do item. Now, in the case of TCP/CP, testing is fun because not only is the whole setup a little bit complicated, you also get lots of nice transient states. Like, for instance, you have, say, 3 packets coming along, happily one after the other, maybe a few microseconds apart. First packet makes it. Second packet, whoa, there comes an alpha particle and poof, knocks it out of your network. Packet goes away. Another packet, the next packet follows, again a few microseconds later, and this one makes it. Now let's assume, just between receiving let's have a fourth packet, yes. So 2 packets make it, the one in the middle gets dropped, and another one comes in. So now you've had a loss. You know that you've had a loss because the packet following the lost packet has also arrived. Now there's another packet coming. Now let's assume that just at that moment the application decides that it would be a great time to move the connection over to another machine. Okay, in principle this should just work, no problem. You lose the fourth packet, but you should be able to recover. The problem is, how are you going to test this? I mean, of course you can pull the plug and you lose a few packets and you put it in and packets come back and well, maybe every once in a while, if you're persistent, you will actually be able to reproduce this scenario. Okay, good. Eventually you do it, or you've just been pulling plugs long enough, they say, okay, now I've covered all the interesting cases. I've done the testing. Good. Okay, next you go to bed, and when you wake up the next evening, you read Linux kernel and see, oh, Andrew Morton has released a new Linux kernel patch, so now we're at, say, 2.6.20. Cool, now let's update our stuff and do the testing again. Things that also make stuff interesting there is that the TCP/IP stack is a little bit complicated, and it changes often. So, again, for this reason, you need to check that not the changes that somebody else did broke your things. Let's think of the case of the timestamps. Since you need to change all the places where the timestamp, well, not all of them, but some of them, you have to choose carefully which ones you change. So you have to change some of the places where timestamps are used. Now, if somebody changes something in the kernel and uses timestamps at another place, that wasn't there before, then of course when you integrate your stuff into the new kernel, the patch will go in perfectly. You will never notice that this new place has popped up, but of course things will not work. And well, they actually might work because this might be just a corner case or in a special configuration that's really exotic and so. But eventually they will show up. So you need to find those things too. Well, there's a solution to this, and this is to build a regression test suite And so you make a lot of regression tests, which are automated. So whenever a new kernel comes out, fine, you do your patching and so on. As soon as things compile, you start to actually use them with the regression tests. So you run your, say, 1,000 or so tests. And then if all of them pass, well, then you can at least be reasonably sure that you didn't overlook anything trivial. There might still be bugs, but once you find them, you add them to your regression test. So the next time a change happens, you will not stumble over the same bugs. Regression tests are a great thing to have. I used to think that, yeah, I mean, all those kind of things that all the good software engineering books talk about, I guess, yeah, sure. It's like sort of particularly advanced table manners. I mean, it might be nice if you know exactly what sort of obscure utensil you have to use when eating lobster, but come on, who cares? And use your fingers. So it's a bit like the same thing for regression tests. I mean, it's sort of in a theoretical ivory tower world, certainly a nice thing to have. But I mean, if I just want to get this bloody code written, then who cares? Well, then I implemented something a little bit more complicated, a program to work with traffic control configuration. And one of the things it does is that it takes basically arbitrary Boolean expressions working on bit sets. Well, header fields in network packets, and kind of recombines them. There's lots of algebraic transformations on this, so it's basically like the digestive process of a cow. So the problem is that this thing has gotten a bit complicated. I mean, it has a fair amount of the things that you would expect to find in a textbook on Boolean algebra. And it's not an easy thing to test. So that's when I really got into writing regression tests. Now, in this particular project, I have about 1,500 regression test cases. And while it was a bit of work to set it up, but there was also, then the payday was when I actually started to port this thing, that whole program, to a 64-bit architecture, Athlon 64. Great new machine. Fine. Now, you have this program that's really complicated, some 40,000 lines. No apologies to the new machine, it compiles without any warnings now. Does it still work? Now, I could, of course, redo all those countless weeks of testing I've done before, but what I had to do instead was just, say, make tests. And go away for a coffee. I mean, that on 64 is really fast, so it didn't take that long to do all those 1,500 tests. Well, a few of them failed, so I knew there were some other things to fix. And I was basically done within the day with porting it to the new platform. I still missed one bug, but that's quite an acceptable score. So regression tests are great. That's what I'm trying to say here. And now, in the case of TCP/CP, when I reached that point, I realized that it's now time to start with regression testing. So I realized, well, there's no way to do this. I don't have the tools. So that's when I shelved this project for about 1.5 years and started to play with another thing called UMLSim. UMLSim uses UML, User Mode Linux. That's UML is a great invention. It's a big project by Jeff Dyke. And what it does is that you can run a Linux system on your Linux system. So you have a user space process which implements a Linux kernel, and inside this you can run all your normal applications. People are using this, for instance, for web hosting. So you have one server, and you give all of your customers, you give them a UML system. So inside this UML system, they can be root, they can do anything they like, they will not be able to break your box. They can break, they can screw up their UML system, but that's fine, it's just the process that dies, who cares? And you can do lots of other fancy things with UML. UML is great. And now I wanted to make it a little bit better by adding basically a thing that works like a debugger. So you can set breakpoints. When you reach a breakpoint, you can go into the kernel and say, okay, so what's happening at these variables here? And you can do even a bit more. You can say, oh, I want to change them. For instance, well, who said that you can only use one kernel? You can have any number of kernels you want. So you have this there's a UMLSim control program which runs a script. Well, it's basically like a programming language, a bit like C and Perl. And so you have, say, two UMLs. In one of them, you put a breakpoint in the blah 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 XMIT function for the network driver. And you do things there. Let's say do a data transfer over the network. You configure all the networking parts. So when the XMIT function is being called, your script gets control. Script is okay. Now let's look over there. Here is the packet. We copy all the packet content into our control program. Now we do things with it. Maybe let it sit there for a little while to simulate some network delay, and then we go to the other side. There we're just waiting until that kernel gets idle, doesn't have anything else to do, and then we go there, do a kmalloc inside this kernel, reconstruct our packet in there, and once it's there, we feed it to the stack. That's great fun. You can do even more. You can control how fast time passes. You can, since time is completely virtual in there, you don't have to wait for war clock time. You can just say, okay, now it's 10 days later, and time jumps. Sometimes you want to do the opposite. Sometimes, let's say you want to simulate a 1,000 gigabit per second network. Well, you don't quite have the hardware for that, but you can still simulate it, and it might take you forever to even simulate what happens in 1 second, but nevertheless, in the simulation, the time will look normal. With this tool now, it's not entirely complete, but it's getting there. Then we'll be able to actually start with the testing. Okay, some other things is to look again at the checkpointing and failover. In the outbound direction, that should be feasible, because even if we have acknowledged any data, we can still retransmit it. I mean, the basic problem is that when you do the checkpointing, and then the system that has done the checkpointing will continue for a little while till the failure. And you need to be able to sort of cover over the things that have happened in between, because you don't have any information about them. So we can retransmit acknowledged data, that's good. We can save our state frequently to avoid problems with sequence numbers, timestamps, and so on. For the timestamps, we can try to synchronize our clocks and try to guess based on the real time, what the timestamps will actually be like. So even though it's not entirely entirely correct, but we might get something that basically always guesses right. The only problem is that you might end up retransmitting a lot of data, so you should do the checkpointing more often. Okay, inbound direction is harder, because the kernel will just acknowledge data that has not been sent to the application yet, so this is unsaved. So you would essentially give the application or something else control over when the acknowledgements are being sent out. And that's kind of tricky, because now you change the timing of acknowledgements. Now there are people who are doing some great research in things with control theory, deep math, and apply this to TCP to try to figure out by how the time that a packet, the round trip time that it takes when you send a packet to the acknowledgements, how this changes depending on the size of the queues in all of the routers on your path. Well, not all of them, only the bottleneck routers are interesting, but still there might be more than one of them. And of course you want to do this in a reliable way, so even if a route changes and things are completely different, you don't fall apart, and lots of things. So of course these people would be really unhappy if you pull this kind of stunt. So this is something that's kind of a researchy topic. Already, just 2 more minutes. So what we have now is basically a proof of concept implementation. That's not entirely correct. Yesterday it was for 2.6.4, today it's also for 2.6.7. And the basic kernel level functionality there is stable, and so this means if you want to experiment with this, it should be something that you can build upon. Still, some things might change in there, but at least the overall design should be right, so it's not kind of a completely new world. There's still a lot of things to do. One is to implement the net-based network traffic switching, after that I've described before. Then, to begin the testing. And also, somebody should start to integrate things with applications and middleware. I would expect that probably the cluster people, like for OpenMOSIX and so on, they might be among the first ones who actually play with this. Because, I mean, their projects are already quite complex, so TCP/CP isn't really a big new item to add. And it sort of fits in with the stuff that they're doing in general. And for applications, It doesn't even the question of whether or not whether it's it really makes sense that an application deals with all of these things. I mean, you might just adapt something like OpenMosix, or there are many other projects which have process migration, all of these types of things. So so there's some integration work to be done. Won't be me doing this, but there are people who know the applications a lot better than I do, and hope they will pick it up. Then there's some more research things like, as I said, do better congestion control. Actually, this reminds me that I didn't show that slide, right? Okay, congestion control. The problem is pretty simple. If you have your system on both ends of a widely different network, and you see and you move your connection over there, and this is your net or router, so that kind of redirects things. So if your connection moves between those two, you cannot really predict what the bandwidth along the path will be like on the new side. So you must really go back to zero and let TCP figure out what is happening. The other extreme is if you're in a LAN, but the only thing that changes is some connection inside your LAN, which might be 100 times faster than your internet connection. With this change, nothing will really change along your path. You're replacing one router that is completely and utterly bored with another router which doesn't have much to do. So you don't create any new bottlenecks. So for this, it would make sense to have some flexibility in choosing for which scenario you optimize. Because in this case, you could just keep on going at full speed, not slow down. Would be nice to have. Okay, back to the conclusions. You can find all of this stuff at the website. And on the website you find, what do you find there? The code, this talk, and also a paper on it that I sent to OLS. And yeah, that's about it. I have some stuff that I can actually demonstrate. This now, for doing this, I need to change the screen resolution, which is probably something that will really upset this beamer. But if somebody is interested in seeing this, I've set up a demo on this machine, so I can show this offline afterwards. You think I can try it? Let's see what happens. Cool. Okay, that was step one. Now, the other obstacle that I didn't mention was that I'm also using a really tiny font. Hey. Here it is. I'm setting up a little network here using UML. And one more. Here we are. It consists of our usual client, our usual two servers, and a router. And there's a little bit of kind of virtual network between the two of them. I'm using UML for all this, so all of this is in software running on this machine here. Now, let's say I begin with the router. So I boot the Linux on this router. I configure my network interfaces. Well, basically the structure is that I have a network between the router and the servers, and a network between the router and the client. So I'm configuring one of those interfaces, the other interface, I'm enabling IP forwarding at the router. And now, as I've shown before, another slide, I'm using the approach with the local routing. So these servers each have one IP address, one private IP address, plus there's a shared IP address, for which we will be using a virtual interface. And now I'm configuring the routing for this shared IP address at my router. Okay, now it tells me that I need to go elsewhere. So I'm going to the server A, I'm booting Linux on it. I'm configuring the network interface, I'm adding my default route, I'm configuring the virtual interface, and I'm starting a little program that's basically a tiny little, very simple telnet daemon. It's not a telnet daemon, because it doesn't understand all those fancy escape sequences that telnet will send, which I found out the hard way, because normally it almost works even if you don't tweet them. Sometimes there's a null in there, and my program just started to crash. I mean, months after it has been working perfectly, and it took me a long time to realize that it was happening over there and not somewhere else in the kernel. Okay, I'm starting my client. I'm configuring my loopback interface, I'm configuring my Ethernet interface, I'm adding my default route, I've already set up my server, so I'll just go ahead and I will connect to this telnet daemon. This takes a little while because there's some configuration thing that I missed in here. I fixed it once, but this was 1.5 years ago, so I've forgotten since what it was. And so we just have to wait a little while. Everything is okay. It's just waiting for the name server, so I think. Meanwhile, I will boot the second server. And I'm configuring my network interface. I'm adding my default route. I'm adding the virtual address. And now we wait for this telnet to succeed reaching my server. Oh, it's there. Great. Now, we don't do any login. We already logged in. So, well, this is just a normal shell. Okay, it doesn't have any editing. So if I make a typo, you can do whatever you want in this shell. Even gives the right error messages. This shell is a little bit special though, because it has two new commands. One command is really handy, it's called hello. And what it does is basically it works like echo, only it doesn't echo back to the place where the command came from, but it echoes on the console of the daemon that is running that shell. So we do the hello here and we see it, the blah blah showing up right down here. The second command is the one that actually uses TCP/CP. It's called dump. What it does is that it takes the kernel state, extracts it, writes it to a file. Since we're on a single machine here, we can just pick it up from the same file system, so we don't even have to send it across the network. Makes things even a bit easier, and also makes debugging easier, another advantage. And yeah, then it just sits there. So we do the dump. Now, that daemon here said that it has done the dump. Here's still our good old telnet, which has just seen the last message from that machine. You see, no response coming. Now, we can go to the new happy owner of that connection. Well, not quite yet. So what we do there is we start another instance of this telnet daemon, but now we tell it to reload the connection state from a file. Poof, we're already back. Okay, this this was a little bit, okay. What happened was, what we see here is now, because we haven't switched another connection yet, you see that? So what happened was that it resurrected the connection, and it just sent the shell prompt, which was in the send buffer here. And this one made it through, because it's not affected by what we do at the router here. However, for anything to go the opposite way, we need to reconfigure our router. Okay, so we delete the old route, and we add our new route. It's done. And lo and behold, our shell is still dead. Now, why is this? Of course, because before I hit a few times return, and, well, here it is back, a bit too fast, actually. I was hoping it would take longer. Well, because I was hitting return for a few times, and it took a little while till I actually switched over the connection. TCP was trying to recover, and normally you have to wait up to about twice the amount of time that TCP has been unable to reach its peer for TCP to recover. So in this case, it was a little bit faster. This can happen. Okay, now let's try to prove that we're really over there on the server. And yes, indeed, now it shows up over there. So the connection has moved. Now what we can do now is also we can look at what was actually the information that has been shuffled around. It's really a pain to type commands here because that... One problem of using UML like this is, as I've demonstrated here, is that you can't send any signals, so I cannot just control C that thing. Nevertheless, what I can do is that I can just start a new shell, show you what it was that we actually sent over this connection. Mm-hmm, a bit more. Here it is. The file _ICI is our internal connection information, the thing that we've passed along here. And dump ICI just does a nice debugging dump. Well, this is, the first of all, there's a bit of administrative information, nothing interesting here. Then we have the connection identifier, source and destination address, port numbers. Then there are all those things that are fixed for the connection, the TCP flags, so the connection was using timestamps, it was using SEC, it was using Windows K. So all of the goodies are there. It's a pretty normal setup, actually. Nothing special about that. I didn't actually do anything with Windows Scale, And the maximum segment size was a little bit less than an Ethernet frame. Well, it's again pretty typical. Now our connection was in established state, as if we didn't know. Here are the sequence numbers, the windows on both sides for the flow control, and last but not least, the timestamp information. This is TSGen, is the state of the timestamp generator at the time when we took the dump, and TS recent is the I forgot which one. One parameter that is related to connection. I think the last timestamp that was sent out or so. And there are no statistics. So yes, this is what happened there. Now, are there any questions? Well, no questions. So then, thanks a lot for listening.